I sure appreciate everybody for being here today. If we have any visitors with us, and we typically do, I want to encourage you to stick around a little bit after our worship service as we convene outside in the fresh air and let us get to know you a little bit better. If you have any spiritual needs, we want to know what those are. We want to know if we can help you in any way to grow closer to God, to understand His will a little bit better through the Bible. If you want a Bible study, we'll sit down and do that with you. If you just want someone to talk to, then we can listen and we'll be there for you. Whatever spiritual issue you're going through right now, we want you to know that this congregation is here as a resource and a comfort for you. A couple of announcements here real quick as we get going. I think Rob might have said that the singing the weekend of our gospel meeting was on Saturday. It's actually on Sunday. A Sunday at 5 o'clock, it'll be here at the building. We'll be outside for that so we can all spread out and social practice our social distancing. Bring a lawn chair of some kind, folding chair, lawn chair, something or another, and we'll meet out in the parking lot. We'll find a nice spot to do that. Also, we're going to be having a men's class October 23rd, scheduled for a Friday night. I think Clay Perry and I are going to do like some kind of arm wrestle to figure out who gets to do that, because I wanted to do it and he wants to do it. And you guys know, if it's up to an arm wrestle, then we'll be at Clay Perry's house October 23rd. So just look for, there'll be information coming out about that, just the time and the place and everything. So just look forward to that. Mark it on your calendar, men of this congregation. We all want to get together. We'll be outside wherever we do it. It'll be outside. So we'll be able to, again, practice our social distancing. But we do plan on doing that Friday, October 23rd. I want to talk about the forest for the trees. That's an old phrase that we use sometimes. You're missing the forest for the trees. And what the phrase means is that sometimes when you have a beautiful forest around you and God's glory just surrounding you, you miss that glory because you focus too much on the little details. That you might stare at a tree, you'll look at its bark and examine its texture, and you focus so much on the little detail of the tree that you don't even notice the glory of the forest. So that phrase, you're missing the forest for the trees, is what I want to talk about today. And I'll ask this question as we get going. Is the Bible meant to be closely examined? Now, we may take it for granted that the answer is yes. But I want to consider that really carefully this morning. Is the Bible meant, is it designed by God to be something that we take so seriously, that we examine it so closely, that we look for every little detail and try to establish a pattern of sound doctrine, and everything that's in the New Testament in particular is meant to be authoritative? Can we base doctrines on even a small amount of evidence where we may have one or two verses that mention something and we may establish an entire doctrinal understanding based on what seems to be scant information? And going back to that old phrase, are we missing the forest for the trees of the Bible by insisting on a hermeneutic that focuses so much on the little details? The word hermeneutic is just a fancy word for interpretation. Are we making a big mistake? When we open up the New Testament, we're combing through it, and we're looking at every little detail, and we're separating out, right? Just like the Pharisees were doing in Matthew chapter 23, we're separating out little leaves from our garden herbs and focusing so much on the details that we're missing actually the entire point of the New Testament. And I hope to explore that with you today. Some examples as we get going here. Sunday assembly, including the Lord's Supper, based on Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. I know that that's been a contentious issue in other congregations in the past. Is we look at Acts 20 verse 7 and we see one congregation in one time period, in one location, that just so happened to be meeting on the Lord's Day to break bread together. And based on Acts 20 verse 7, we claim that we have the authority then to meet every single Sunday as a church to partake of the Lord's Supper. I think another good example is the local authority and the plurality of elders. You look at like 1 Peter chapter 5 verses 1 and 2. And there's a few little details in there in 1 Peter 5. And it talks about how the elders who are among you. And we go, ha, it says among you. Therefore, elders only have local authority. The elders who are among you. We look at the plurality. We say it's elders, plural, not elder, singular. And based on, again, what seems to other people to be scant information, we say elders must be a plurality and their authority only extends to the local level and not beyond that. Maybe another example is our insistence on a cappella singing based on two verses. Colossians 3:16 and Ephesians 5 verse 19. It says to sing and to make melody with your hearts to the Lord. And based on those verses, we've concluded then that the authority is for us to sing and to sing alone. So those are just a few examples. These are some of the typical things that as you're talking to your religious friends, your Baptist friend, your Christian church friend, your non-denominational type of friend who goes to a community church or something, as you're talking to your religious friends, these are a lot of the typical examples that they'll kind of throw back at you and say, oh, well, you go to a Church of Christ. I heard that you guys do some really weird things based on like very little information from the Bible. And these are three really typical examples that you're going to find. And I wonder, is the church too worried about little arguments about sound doctrine that it has lost touch with its true mission? Let's acknowledge something first before we go any further in this lesson. There is a danger of having death by details. And so if you think that this lesson is going to be me dismissing that danger and saying, let's stick to the Church of Christ script and let's argue about instrumental music and let's argue about hermeneutics and let's really, if you think that this is going to be sticking to that script and that I'm going to dismiss the danger that's being introduced by our religious friends when we have this conversation, don't think that for a moment. Just dismiss that now. We need to acknowledge that there are real dangers of losing focus on the big picture by elevating things that are subordinate to the big picture. Now, I already referenced Matthew chapter 23, but let's go there and look at a couple things here before we move on. In Matthew chapter 23, notice where it says here in verse 23 and 24. Matthew 23, beginning in verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice, mercy, faithfulness. But these are the things that you should have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, he says in verse 24, you strain out a gnat, but you swallow a camel. I've always liked that, by the way. If anybody doesn't think Jesus had a sense of humor or didn't know how to level a little bit of sarcasm, you've missed Matthew 23. You strain out a gnat, but you end up swallowing a camel. You put all that effort into straining out a little tiny thing. You focus on a little tiny detail like that, but all the while you're going, I wonder why my stomach feels so bad and it's got this camel-sized lump off to the side. Because you focus so much on the details, you missed the big picture. And it's the big picture that saves us. You blind guides, you hypocrites, he says. You're elevating things that are subordinate to the big picture. Now, let's be clear about this. Jesus calls them subordinate. He calls them subordinate. You've neglected the weightier provisions of the law. The very fact that something can be called a weightier provision of the law implies that there is something that is not as weighty in the law. In order for something to be weightier, it has to be weightier than something else. So Jesus acknowledges that there are things in the law that are subordinate to justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Now, I use the word subordinate because I don't call them inferior. I think we make that mistake sometimes where we think that they're not important, that they're inferior, that they don't have any purpose to them. No, they're just subordinate to that. It means that there are concepts in the law that are the big picture concepts, and everything below that is there to establish those big picture concepts. Jesus is not saying that tithing garden herbs isn't something you should be doing. Jesus is not saying that the Sabbath day was not important. Jesus is not saying that in the law, things like circumcision and food laws, he's not saying that the Passover didn't have a purpose or that it was pointless. He's just saying, you should have done all of those things without neglecting the big picture stuff. You got to do both of them. But you find death by details when you think that the subordinate information is more important than the stuff it was supposed to be establishing all along. And while Christian doctrine is not the same thing as quote-unquote the law that is so frequently discussed in the New Testament, in the book of Romans or Galatians, for example, there is a parallel that's hard to ignore. Watch out that you're not falling for the same trap that's discussed in passages like Galatians 3 and verse 10. Notice here in Galatians 3 verse 10, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law to perform them." That's the danger, isn't it? That if you think that salvation is somehow going to be found in, I'm going to check off all the boxes, I'm going to do all the little details, I'm going to do all the little things, and I'm going to get to heaven and God is going to go, "Well, I'll tell you what, you typically had a pretty bad attitude about life, but it's hard to ignore the record." Right? If that's your attitude, Paul's warning is, and he's pulling from the old law itself, Paul's warning is, you're cursed if you make even one mistake. Right? That's the catch to the law, isn't it? The catch is, and I don't mean this literally because I think this is a mistake to assume this is what the law was about, but I'm just saying, kind of playing along with that false mentality, if you're making this mistake of, I just have to follow all the law and do it perfectly and God will be happy with me, I just have to do everything perfect, watch out. Because the moment that you make a single mistake, you have violated the law. Now that is also echoed in James chapter 2 and verse 10. Look what the writer of James has to say here. He says, "For whoever keeps the whole law, yet stumbles in a single point, has become guilty of the entire law." That's a little scary, isn't it? That you could do, and I mean this hyperbolically, right? You could do it 99.99999999, I'm a 10-year-old kid apparently, percent, right? But it's that last, that one, that final mistake that you make, that's it. And that's scary, isn't it? That's the scary thing about thinking that you can be justified by law. Justification by works of the law is a lot like drinking salt water. The more gulps of it you take, the thirstier you become. Don't fall for that mentality. Don't fall for the mentality that if you just do everything right, if you just get it perfect, if you just put enough effort in to the little fine details and having all the right sound doctrine and making sure your tie is straight on Sundays, that somehow or another, you're going to make it. It's like drinking salt water. You drink it, and you drink it, and you drink it, and the more you drink it, the closer you get to dying of thirst. Am I saved because of my doctrine? The answer is, of course not. Of course not. We can only rest the question of salvation on doctrine if we have looked at the big picture first. Because I'm not saved by doctrine, I'm saved by the grace of Jesus Christ. Going back to Matthew chapter 23, Jesus uses a word repeatedly in that chapter. And this is the great diatribe on the Pharisees and the scribes. He says, "Scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You hypocrites." I'm sure that you're familiar with this. Perhaps other preachers have said it before. Maybe I've even said it a time or two in a sermon. But the word hypocrite in the Greek is hypokrites. It's a great word, isn't it? Because it's one of those Greek words that looks and sounds a lot like its English equivalent, hypokrites. And hypokrites literally means somebody who's a mask wearer, somebody who has two faces. And so in Greek and Roman theater, they would wear masks. In fact, they would wear masks as well as voice augmenting devices, right? They'd have things that were attached to them that would either change the sound of their voice or somehow amplify the sound of their voice. So it's not just that you were a two-faced person. You could be a two-voiced person. Hypocrites literally means a mask wearer. An actor. And Jesus says, "Scribes and Pharisees, woe to you, you're actors, you're mask wearers. You've got two faces, you've got two voices. You are hypocrites." We've got to be very careful that we're not the exact same thing. Hypocrites, who look one part, but are another part on the inside. My friend, sound doctrine is a good thing. Let's be clear about that. In fact, even in the word sound, in the Greek, when you see sound doctrine in 2 Timothy 1:13 or Titus 2 verse 1, when you read the word sound doctrine, it's healthy doctrine. That's what it literally means in the Greek, is healthy doctrine. Sound doctrine is healthy doctrine. It's good doctrine. Look at a couple passages here. In 2 Timothy 1 and verse 13, the writer says here, 2 Timothy 1 verse 13, "Retain the standard of sound, healthy, healthy words, which you have heard from me in the faith and the love which are in Christ Jesus." Notice in Titus chapter 2 verse 1, Titus 2, just a couple pages over, and verse 1, "But as for you, speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine," healthy doctrine. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 16 says, in 1 Timothy 4 verse 16, "Pay close attention to yourself and to your teaching. Persevere in these things, for as you do this, you will ensure salvation both for yourself and for those who hear you." And so I'll put it this way, you're not saved by sound doctrine, but sound doctrine will ensure salvation both for you and for those who hear you. Sound doctrine is not divorced from salvation, right? We need to be careful about that. You're saved by the grace of Jesus Christ, but according to 1 Timothy 4 and verse 16, what you teach and what you preach very much has to do with whether you're saved or not. And so we need to be unapologetic in our devotion to sound doctrine, no matter how different it makes us seem from the broader religious community. This lesson is not an indictment of sound doctrine, and it is not an indictment of our insistence upon sound doctrine. But one can easily slip into the same hypocrisy of Matthew chapter 23 when the big picture of the gospel is missed while insisting on minutia. Romans chapter 2 explores this very troubling condition as well. If you're in my Romans class, I apologize, as we just studied this a couple weeks ago. But in Romans chapter 2, he talks about, and I believe it's to the Jewish Christian audience here, the formerly Jewish converts to Christ who are members of the churches in Rome that he's talking to here. But he says in verse 1, "You are without excuse, every one of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things. We know," he says in verse 2, "that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. Do you suppose this, O man," verse 3, "when you pass judgment upon those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you're going to escape the judgment of God?" He goes on in verse 17, that if you bear the name Jew, and I know, I don't want to do a disservice to the text, but just kind of play along with me here. Replace the word Jew and some of the accompanying terminology with Christian. "But if you bear the name of Christ and you rely upon the New Testament and all of its sound doctrine, and you boast in God and you know His will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the New Testament, and you're confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in your sound doctrine from the New Testament the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? And if you tell others to steal, are you stealing? And if you tell other people to have a perfect marriage, are you not living in a perfect marriage? And if you tell others to leave the world of idolatry and covetousness and materialism, but you yourself are just as covetous and materialistic as any worldly person, what do you think God is going to do with that person just because you wear the name of Christ so proudly?" Remember that hollow adherence to sound doctrine has always been despicable to God. That's not new. That's not a new concept today. That has always been God's attitude toward hollow, toward empty, superficial, hypocritical obedience to His will. And there's several passages up on the screen that I think illustrate this point. Our scripture reading from a few moments ago was from Micah chapter 6. And in Micah chapter 6, and as well as others here, I want to go to, since we read Micah 6 already, let's go to this Hosea passage now. In Hosea chapter 6 and verse 6, since Micah was our scripture reading, let's see what Hosea has to say here in Hosea 6 verse 6. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But he says in verse 7, like Adam, they've transgressed the covenant. They have dealt treacherously against me. And Amos chapter 5 verses 21 through 24 brings out a very similar point as well. Now, let's be clear. Is God saying, I don't care about sacrifices? Is God saying, I don't care about obedience to the law? Do whatever you want. I don't really care what you do with the sacrifices. Or is God saying, and of course you know where I'm going with this, I want you to love me genuinely, deeply, honestly. I want you to care about justice. And I want you to care about charity. And I want you to care about kindness. And I want you to care about righteousness. And I want you to care about standing before me with a clear conscience. I want you to care about that. And if you love God, and if you love righteousness, and if you love mercy, and if you love justice, guess what? All the other stuff will happen quite naturally. Because if you love God, you'd be willing to sacrifice anything for Him. And if you love justice, then you will stand up for justice when the time comes. And if you love mercy, then you'll forgive others as you have been forgiven. And if you love God, you'll worship Him. And you'll stand before His altar with a clear conscience because you know that His grace has come into your life. God has always cared about sound doctrine. What He doesn't care about is empty obedience to sound doctrine. He wants your love. And true love for God will manifest itself in obedience and sound doctrine quite naturally. With all that being said, there is precedent for establishing doctrines, beliefs, and practices by zeroing in on tiny details. Let's make sure that we're being fair to the Bible here and the Bible's writers. Peter and Paul and James and John very much cared that you looked at the details in their writing. They very much cared that you put effort into what is he actually saying here? What are the fine details in the scriptures? They were very economical writers. They were writers who were inspired by the Holy Spirit Himself. They were writers who put effort into the details so that we could put effort into the details. And I'll give you some examples of this. That there is precedent for us to take the scriptures and look for fine details and even establish very large, important doctrines based on fine details. Jesus Himself did the same thing. Jesus extracted huge theological concepts from seemingly tiny details in the scriptures. Two examples in Matthew chapter 22. Look what He has to say here in this conversation that He has in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 31. Verses 31 and 32. And of course, He's speaking to the Sadducees here. In response to this silly hypothetical situation that the Sadducees throw at Him in the preceding verses, Jesus says here in verse 31, but regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that which was spoken to you by God? So here's Jesus affirming the inspiration of the scriptures. And He says here, by God saying, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. Okay, now we might very easily just read on through Exodus chapter 3 and not even notice this little detail that God's throwing in there. The old burning bush is saying something that is very easy to miss. Jesus doesn't miss it. Jesus takes a seemingly minor detail from the text, something that you could very easily step right over on your way through it. And He bases a huge theological concept on that. I am. What tense is that? You remember back in seventh grade English class? What tense are we in? I am present tense. Not I was past tense or I'm going to be future tense. I am present tense, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And here's the concept that Jesus is extracting from a very tiny detail. He's saying that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive. In some spiritual sense, right? That you continue to exist in some sense. That even when the physical body dies, there's a part of you, the spiritual part of you, that is ever present. That it always exists. That you will be raised up one day. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not just cease to exist when they died. They didn't just cease to exist and go into oblivion. God is right now the God of Abraham, though Abraham is not physically alive. Now, again, that's a little tiny detail, and Jesus is saying, you will be raised up based on the present tense of I am the God of Abraham. That's a really tiny detail to establish the resurrection upon. But he doesn't hold off there. He does it again later on in the chapter in verses 41 through 45. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question saying, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And they said to him, well, he's the son of David. And he said to them in verse 43, then how does David in the spirit call him Lord, saying, it's a quote from Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put thine enemies beneath thy feet. If David calls him Lord, then how is he his son? Again, you might read Psalm 110 and never even notice the interplay between those two words there. The Lord said to my Lord. And what Jesus is saying is, David wrote that psalm. You guys are claiming that the Messiah is inferior to David. That it goes like, God, David is the great king, and then the Messiah is over there. He's the son of David, right? It's actually the other way around, because David said, the Lord said to my Lord being the Messiah, the Lord said to my Lord. And so from a seemingly minor detail in the text, Jesus again is able to extract a huge concept. Other writers do the same thing. Paul made the same point in Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, where he takes a very small detail but builds a huge point. Galatians 3, verse 16. Now the promises, going back to the promise to Abraham in the book of Genesis, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Now he does not say, and to seeds, plural, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. So based on singular versus plural, right? Again, a very minor detail in the text, something you might not even notice. When you go back to that promise to Abraham, and to your seed, I've given this promise, this blessing, that all the world, all the children of the earth will be blessed in your seed. From a seemingly minor detail, Paul is able to establish a huge concept. The Hebrew writer did the same thing in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 13. He's quoting from Jeremiah chapter 31, and he says here, when he said a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Wait a minute. You can read Jeremiah 31. Is there anywhere in Jeremiah 31 where Jeremiah 31 actually says the old covenant is obsolete? I don't see that anywhere in Jeremiah 31 where it is explicitly said that the old covenant becomes obsolete. But the writer of Hebrews says, based on a new covenant, that single phrase, if you have a new covenant, then what's being implied in that statement is the old covenant must be obsolete. The text never said it was obsolete, but he takes a little detail from the text and draws a huge conclusion from a little detail. And again, Genesis chapter 15, verse 6 as well. I mean, we see that repeatedly in Romans and in Galatians, that faith was reckoned to Abraham as righteousness. And the New Testament writers frequently take Genesis 15, verse 6, a very small verse, by the way, just one little old verse about faith being reckoned as righteousness, And it seems as if, and I don't think this is an overstatement, it seems as if just about the biggest concept in all of the Christian faith is established on that point, that faith is reckoned to Abraham as righteousness. A little tiny verse all the way back in Genesis. And yet one of the biggest concepts in all of our faith is established on that one little verse. So how do we find the balance, okay? Because it seems like I'm talking out of both sides of my hypocritical face, right? That on the one hand, there's all these dangers. It's so dangerous to focus on the minutiae that if you focus too much on the details, you miss the big picture. It's so dangerous to always harp on sound doctrine and get all caught up in those kinds of debates. But then the other side of that is, right, well, don't we need to look at the big picture? And how do you find the balance between those things? Well, by living the mission. Living the mission. It was 51 years ago, not today, but this year. If my math is right, somebody do the math for me. Yeah. 51 years ago that Americans landed on the moon. Apollo 11 landed, and I want to give you an interesting little piece of info here. Here's your trivia for the day, okay? It took around 400,000 people to make that mission a success. 400,000 people. 400,000 people had a hand in some way of getting the men on that spacecraft to the moon and home. 400,000 people had some hand in making that mission a success. Think about that. 400,000. Now, that is 400,000 people, most of whom were doing mundane, highly detailed, mind-numbingly precise things. You're not winging it when it comes to the moon, right? When it comes to going to the moon, there's no like, hey, you just gotta aim over to the right there. There's no winging it. There's no thinking on your toes and just sort of making it up as you go. They didn't just go to space and say, boy, it looks awfully far away, but I hope we brought enough ice cream, right? Hope we brought enough astronaut ice cream. You know what's funny is, if I'm remembering this, here's the other piece of trivia. I don't think that astronaut ice cream has ever actually been eaten by astronauts in space. I don't think they actually send it up with the astronauts, which is a little bit sad, isn't it? You can buy it at NASA, but they can't get it on the space station. But that's 400,000 people who did mostly detailed, mundane tasks. It was a bolt over here, a wire over here, cleaning the dust out of this thing, an air filter over here, checking the threads and all the seams, the sewing, the doctors and the physicians and the nurses, people just cleaning the facility, right? Just people cleaning the bathrooms, mopping the floors at NASA, the accountants who made the finances work, the mathematician that made all the math work, the engineers and the 400,000 people. And out of 400,000 people that got Apollo 11 there and back, how many of them actually got to go to the moon? Two of them, right? Collins was left on the other craft to float around for a while and watch everyone else do the fun stuff. 400,000 people did a lot of really, really detailed stuff. Now here's my point, because you're wondering what in the world it is. Every single nut and every single bolt, every single wire, every seam in every article of clothing, every calculation and every single computation was important, if not outright essential, to the success of this mission. But in the midst of all this fine detail, they needed to remember something. We are going to the moon. We're going to the moon. Don't forget that if you are in the nuts and the bolts and the math calculation, don't forget to look up every now and then from that sheet of math problems that you're doing. Don't forget to look up from that sewing machine. Don't forget to look up from the floor that you're mopping, to look up at that moon in the sky and go, you know why I'm doing this? Because we're going to the moon. All of that detail was subordinate to a really, really cool mission. I frequently hear complaints that the church has lost sight of the mission. And that might be partially true. If we're going to insist on the details, we need to keep the mission front and center. We're not going to the moon. We're going somewhere better than the moon. If you're going to insist on the New Testament pattern of benevolence, then you need to get out and do some charity as an individual. If you're going to make that argument that in benevolence to unbelievers is individual, and I would make that argument, well, then I better go out and practice in charity if I'm going to make that argument. If singing is the prescribed method of worshiping God in the New Testament, if we're going to make that argument, and we're not going to have the rock band and the laser light show and the smoke machine and all that stuff, if we're going to make that argument, then we better be singing with all of our heart. We need to show what a human voice can do. If you're going to make the argument that social functions are not to be funded by church funds, if you're going to make the argument that it's not within the bounds and authority of the Scriptures to build a fellowship hall and a kitchen and to have a gymnasium and a rock climbing wall and all that sort of thing, if you're going to make that argument, and I would, you better go out and do some hospitality then. And spend some time with your brothers and sisters in Christ. We are part of something amazing and beautiful and dramatic and heroic and epic. And a life spent in obedience to God's will is always going to be greater than the sum of its parts. Sound doctrine is essential, but not nearly so essential as the grace of Jesus Christ that's coming into your life. And that must be subordinate to the big picture. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. This is an opportunity that we provide every time we come together as a church to reach out to those who are in our midst today who have a spiritual need of some kind. Listen to the gospel put so simply in Mark 16, verse 16. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So whatever need you might have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.